A Middle Eastern country took some major steps towards developing a nuclear weapon this week. It's not Iran, and they had America's help. We've also had a lot of nuclear news out of Europe, including a pretty alarming report from Russia. And in the UK, a new leader has his finger on the nuclear button. Prime Minister Andy Burnham took office. We'll look at his new cabinet and more on today's Trumpet World. Saudi Arabia has been a major focus of the news this week. The Houthis, their great adversaries in Yemen, look like they're joining in the Iran war with massive implications for Saudi Arabia, massive implications for your wallet as petrol prices soar up to, or at least close to new highs. Perhaps to make up for that, America is looking at helping them with their nuclear program. So lots of pretty long-range, far-reaching implications for both of these stories. We'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic. Mihailo, perhaps you could just begin by giving us an overview of the week's news in this region.
Yes, as you mentioned, on Monday, the Houthis declared a blockade on Saudi Arabia of any ships visiting Saudi ports. They made good on their threat yesterday when they claimed to attack two ships. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, United States President Donald Trump announced that he's finalized an agreement with Saudi Arabia to help them develop a civilian nuclear program. That agreement now will go under the scrutiny of Congress. The very next day, even though the agreement was already signed, President Trump said that now it getting implemented was conditional on Saudi Arabia joining the Abraham Accords and recognizing Israel. The Saudis have been mute as to whether they knew about this ahead of time, what their position will be. But that's the state of play in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia as of today.
So I think the nuclear program is probably the much bigger long-term significance. But the Houthi strikes are what is kind of affecting us, I think, more in the here and now. So maybe we'll start with that. So obviously, Saudi Arabia, generally, they had the bulk of their shipping, the bulk of their exports coming out through the Strait of Hormuz. Now, they knew about this vulnerability ahead of time. They built a pipeline taking their oil from where it's mostly comes out of the ground over near the Strait of Hormuz and the Arabian Gulf, bringing that all across to a terminus on the Red Sea ports. And so despite Hormuz being closed, so far, they've still been able to sell some oil. Now the Houthis are threatening that. How much is Saudi Arabia able to get out at this point? Is it a total shutdown? Are they still able to send some oil to the Mediterranean? How are they coping with these attacks?
Well, at this point, the attacks have been fairly limited. We haven't actually seen the Houthis, say, try to strike those oil terminuses further north. Looks like they're mainly targeting, as they did before in the October 7th war, shipping going through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which directly borders Houthi territory. They have been able to rebuild their capabilities quite significantly since Israel bombed them, but before the bombing to now, they've never been a conventional force that could seriously threaten the Saudi sovereignty on its own territory. But that's the whole point. The uncertainty, I mean, is the whole point of what makes everything so nerve-wracking. To this day, most shippers have been avoiding the Red Sea precisely because they don't know what the Houthis are going to be up to. And now that the Houthis have been adding to that uncertainty, that's where you got yesterday, I believe, the oil or the price of oil reached over $100 a barrel, the highest it's been in over a month. And that, of course, affects insurance rates, everything else. So the Houthis, even if they don't have that much strong power, they have a lot of leverage over the global economy and Saudi Arabia, which is dependent on these trade routes to be able to export just by causing this uncertainty.
Yeah, if you are driving an oil tanker and you have a 1 in 10 or even 1 in 20 chance of being attacked, you're probably not going to run that risk, even if you might make a bit of money by doing so. So they don't need to be able to sink every single ship coming out of the Red Sea to make a big difference. So we are seeing, we had oil come down as we had peace talks around mid-June. Now it's the first time since May oil is back over $100 a barrel. or at least hit that on some markets last night. Maybe if we go to Andrew Miller, bring in our US correspondent. I mean, what's the picture like in for the US economy? And in some ways, my big question is kind of like, why aren't people freaking out more? If both the Red Sea and Hormuz get shut down on a long-term basis, I guess markets are probably assuming Donald Trump is going to get all this under control.
It seems like it, because there hasn't been as much market turmoil as you'd expect in a case like this. But it's definitely significant into like looking at U.S. long-term strategy, because even though the North American continent is oil self-sufficient, oil's still a globally traded commodity. So if supply is restricted and demand stays the same, price goes up. So prices are going up, and that means the amount of money it takes to fill up your gas tank on your car is going to go up, but also the amount of money it takes to fill up the gas tank on every semi-truck that brings your groceries and other goods to Walmart, and the grocery stores are going to go up. So it brings prices up overall. And so the last inflation report in the United States, we saw that inflation had pretty much hit in its highest level in a few years, back highest level since the Biden inflation times. But the number was interesting because while the Biden inflation epidemic was largely driven by the fact that you printed so much money during the COVID pandemic that you diluted the money supply. America's core inflation, which excludes fuel and food, is actually relatively low. So this isn't so much a case of the money supply being diluted as it is a case of just everything's getting more expensive because everything gets to the vehicle on a truck. And so politically, this is significant because I feel like inflation and gas prices are things that everyday people are concerned about, and even everyday people who are fairly short-sighted. So I feel like if you're looking at a case like this, and you're looking like, okay, we're like, well, Iran becoming a nuclear power, you're risking nuclear World War III, which is way worse than having high gas prices. So the high gas prices, these are something that people aren't going to be happy about, but it's like a sacrifice you should be willing to make if you're thinking long term. Most Americans don't think long term. Unfortunately, they're concerned about what's affecting them here and now, which means the Iran war is unpopular. We're heading into an election here in just a few months. And so the Trump administration's going to be under tremendous pressure to bring down the inflation rate before the elections. I think we mentioned on this program a few weeks ago that back when Trump went to Paris the last time and he thought he had an Iran deal in place, he was telling people out loud in Paris that the U.S.'s emergency oil reserves were at historic lows and they actually could be drained completely if he didn't come up with a deal with Iran. So he was presenting his deal as, oh, I just saved America from like completely exhausting its oil reserves. Well, then that deal fell apart. We're back to war. The straits closed again. They're now threatening another strait that's responsible for another 10% of the world's oil, which means in order to keep gas prices down, it's almost a sure thing you're going to keep draining the emergency oil reserves. And the American people are going to have to make sacrifices if they want to make sure Iran's not going to become a nuclear power. Since they don't seem like they're willing to make those sacrifices, I believe the Trump administration, despite the setback, is going to keep pushing for some sort of nuclear deal. And that ties right back into the observation you made earlier. If, like, it would be horrible for America's strategic oil reserve to be drained. So why isn't the stock market going crazy? Why aren't more, or even more crazy than it is, why aren't more people freaking out? And I feel like the fact that if people aren't freaking out, the expectation is that Trump's still going to pull off some sort of deal that opens the strait, even if it does leave Iran with the capacity to maintain some of its uranium and nuclear capacity that we originally went to war with them to stop.
That's a good point. And so we could see some of that financial pressure lifted soon. But at the same time, there's a lot of pretty long-term financial pressures building. And this week, Ukraine and Russia have started hitting each other's grain exporting industries pretty hard. Like you've got a perfect storm almost of food prices. A lot of fertilizer is manufactured in the Persian or the Arabian Gulf and exported via Hormuz. That's not being exported. Our agricultural industry, rightly or wrongly, relies on fertilizers. That's going to hit the amount of food that's grown. Now what's happening in Ukraine and Russia is going to hit the amount of food that's exported. That's a pressure on inflation. You've got what's happening with Hormuz, the Red Sea. And part of the reason I wanted to start with looking at this topic as well is we had a great interview on Wednesday's show. Mihailo Zekic was interviewing the CEO of Raksha Intelligence Futures Foundation, where they were getting into the long-term pressures on sea gates, the long-term implications, the kind of the new world that we're heading into, where what you could, in a very technical term, call geopolitical risk, that sounds very abstract and very remote and something that ordinary people don't need to worry about, is translating to high prices, high debt, economic collapse. So that was a half an hour interview that you can get on our website or on YouTube. Will Taiwan fall because of Iran? Lots of really interesting material on sea gates and choke points there. But bringing things back to this week, obviously having a nuclear arms race in the Middle East, well, that's potentially even more destructive than some of these choke points getting cut off. Now, nuclear arms race, that really brings up the question, Mihailo, how distant is this from a military project? How likely is this to be military? Because, you know, very clearly, this is a civilian project. As you pointed out, there are safeguards. America's doing the enriching to limit what technology that could potentially be militarized is handed over to Saudi Arabia. Are there any implications that Saudi Arabia could do something militarily, make steps towards a nuclear bomb with what they're gaining from this deal?
Well, the jury's out. Saudi Arabia is a bit notorious for having grand ambitions with infrastructure projects and those failing miserably. There's the artificial city on the Red Sea coast that has collapsed for a bit. And a lot of people think the nuclear program's in the same vein. They have a lot of great goals that they want to put out there, but their actual capability of putting them in fruition is called into question. With that being said, from what at least I could see, okay, it's one reactor. It's not like there's going to be this huge infrastructure development like what Iran has with all these different centrifuge sites scattered around everywhere. Iran has years of experience in this kind of thing Saudi Arabia doesn't have. But the big question is, it all depends on the goodwill of the U.S. Saudi Arabia, from what we can understand, again, the text hasn't been made public yet, will have enrichment capability. They're just not allowed to use that until the U.S. does a review for them after 2 years of it formally starting. Say, if things get more chaotic in the Middle East, the U.S. has to stop or isn't able to put as much focus on all these different international obligations it has, the infrastructure will still be there, and the Saudis, from what we can understand, can go full steam ahead if they so choose. And if America is unwilling or unable to stop, then at this point, America would have been given the Saudis everything they would have needed to go forward with that. Again, Iran, even with its damaged state at the moment, has far more infrastructure available and expertise than Saudi Arabia does. And if Saudi Arabia wanted to play keep up with Iran, it would require quite a Herculean effort on their part to get there. And it's unknown if they have the energy for that, no pun intended. But they're getting a lot more than they would have right now. And if they wanted a nuclear weapon, it would be very hard for them to do so without what they're receiving from the Americans.
And of all the nations on the planet, this is probably the one that needs nuclear power the least, that has oil available in the largest quantities for the cheapest extraction costs. I mean, I think Russia or the United States, they may well be getting more oil out, but Saudi Arabia can get at it very cheaply. They have cheap energy. And even if they were to, say, for climate reasons, or they run out of oil, it's not renewable, I mean, the entire country's a desert. They could manufacture solar energy really cheaply as well. There are lots of very interesting projects, too, that are using sand as energy storage device. Like, they have so many other ways of getting electricity so much more cheaply.
They have about 30 million people. That's less than the population of California. It's not like they have like China's population where they're constantly running out of electricity needs. As you said, most of the land isn't even developed. It's not like you need to spread electrical substations to every little corner of the desert.
So it's hard to see why they would even want a nuclear program if it's not to develop nuclear weapons. I mean, on this point about obstacles for them, is there the potential for them to get help from Pakistan? Because obviously this is a relationship that has been deepening. These two have developed quite a close nuclear relationship. Pakistan has a nuclear program. Could they get some help there?
Well, there were rumors years ago that they were going to purchase a weapon from Pakistan. That apparently never happened, but Saudi Arabia has a lot of money to throw to vanity projects, and Pakistan needs a lot of money, so it's if push came to shove, that's not an unlikely scenario. What we've seen and what we've discussed before in this program is that Saudi Arabia has signed a mutual defense agreement with Pakistan that Pakistan apparently was taking seriously enough to send thousands of soldiers to Saudi Arabia to defend it from Iran during the war's active fighting. Pakistan actually shares a physical border with Iran on Iran's eastern side. And so if that did flare up in the Persian Gulf itself, I'd find it very hard to see it not spreading to the physical border. I think that would probably, at this point, Saudi Arabia is satisfied with what Pakistan is offering them. Why would they need to purchase their own nuclear weapons when they're already under Iran's or Pakistan's nuclear umbrella? I'm glad you brought that up, though, because this week we've also seen developments that Pakistan is negotiating with Kuwait with a similar agreement. Apparently, from what details we can see, it's not going to be as comprehensive as the Saudi agreement, but the idea of Kuwait falling under Pakistan's nuclear umbrella is still an open question. They've also been attacked by Iran. They're much smaller. They can't defend themselves as much. And they also have the recent history of being occupied by Iraq, which is still in the fresh on the minds of many people there. And so they're taking the idea of being attacked militarily and having their sovereignty violated very seriously. Pakistan, I think they're probably hoping they're making a lot of promises they never have to keep, and they'll receive the money from those promises and never have to put it into practice. But I think the fact that they've made it as far as they have, both with the text on the paper and what they followed through in their obligations, has taken a lot of people by surprise, and it's certainly an area to watch.
Oh, yeah. If I can just jump in here for a minute. I also think that a story like this, it really highlights something that Herbert Armstrong said about the American people, and really the fact that they just, for some reason, have this inability to see more than one enemy at a time. Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who was briefly Donald Trump's national security advisor in his first administration, wrote a book called Field in Fight that really highlighted the threat to world peace of a nuclear-armed Iran. a lot of good parts of that book. One of the parts of the book I don't agree with so much has bearing on the situation and reflects a viewpoint among some in the Trump administration that we need a nuclear-armed Saudi Arabia in order to contain Iran. It's based off like the 19th century theory of like balance of powers that like, well, you know, like if Iran does eventually get a nuclear weapon, or in this case, if America's negotiating to open Hormuz and like Iran does get a nuclear weapon, you don't want Iran to be the only nuclear power in the Arab in the Muslim world. Because then like they can use that threat to dominate the Middle East. And so if you've got a couple other nations like Saudi Arabia who are also nuclear powers who are on America's side, then you can kind of like use the threat of mutually assured destruction to keep the Iranians in place. And it is a strategy with some logic behind it. However, we do know from Bible prophecy that Saudi Arabia is not going to align itself with Iran. It's going to remain a rival of Iran. But it will eventually align itself with Europe against the United States. Which means if Saudi Arabia does, in fact, develop a nuclear program or even get nuclear weapons at some point, it's not impossible that those weapons at some point in the future would be used against the United States. And so in this particular situation, I can't say for certain that's why Donald Trump's doing this, that he wants them to have a nuclear program so they can get a nuclear weapon to contain Iran. But that's very likely what the Saudis are thinking. And there are some very strong Trump supporters in his administration who have floated that theory before, Michael Flynn amongst them, that it's in America's interest to have a nuclear-armed Saudi Arabia in order to contain the Iranian threat.
I think it's also worth mentioning that this wasn't that long ago. Most of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudis, and I think it's fairly conventionally accepted that some level of the Saudi state had foreknowledge of the attacks and at the very least gave their blessing. It probably doesn't go all the way up to the king, but how high it goes up is an open question. And there are still many, many people within Saudi Arabia that would like or would see America as a threat if it weren't for their iron-fisted monarchy that's not accountable to the people. And same thing, other views with Israel, which we'll get to in a little bit of a moment. So even if the one strong man at the top right now has good relations with the United States, that doesn't mean many, if not most of his people see eye to eye with him.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance in this because there are people that will point to Saudi Arabia and the radicalism there to try and argue kind of the opposite of Michael Flynn and say, actually, we should ally with Iran because Saudi Arabia is the real bad guy of the Middle East. And that's not true. I think Iran is definitely the greater of the two evils. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia are absolute good guys. And any foreign policy that does kind of say, well, the enemy of my enemy is great and I can trust them, it falls into exactly that trap that that Andrew mentioned, that Mr. Armstrong used to talk about, of only looking to at only seeing one enemy at a time. And really that's something that does come from trusting in man and having to do those kind of deals and relationships, even like you were talking about last week, Mihailo, with Israel trying to ally with Ahmadinejad that had pledged to wipe them off the map, which I think does bring us to Israel. One of the most concerning, or one of the big reasons to be concerned about this, I think, is that Israel is concerned that they are not at all happy with this idea of an Iranian nuclear program, which, if it's civilian, if it's purely civilian, who cares? Doesn't really affect them. The fact that they are worried, I think, shows that they're not taking it for granted that it's just going to remain civilian.
Well, actually, it's a mixed bag. From what we can tell, a lot of security officials within Israel have been giving anonymous leaks to the media saying, this is stupid. Why is America doing this? This is our red line. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he's basically indicated that if this is what it takes to finally get A Saudi embassy in Tel Aviv and an Israeli embassy in Riyadh. Will we fully support President Trump moving forward with this? And it does appear there is a friction between the actual decision makers at the top of Israel's government and the mid-level people who are actually involved in the nitty-gritty of Israel's security. The Saudi normalization has been a long-sought achievement from the Netanyahu government. He talks about it even in his biography that he wrote when he was in opposition last. And Netanyahu's heading in for a very difficult election year where most polls are suggesting he may lose government and may never be able to recover it again. If he wants to avoid that fate, he would need to pull some kind of magical foreign policy victory out of thin air to artificial is the wrong word, but to out of nowhere boost his credentials with something that's not in factor right now with the current political climate. And arguably a Saudi normalization deal, as difficult as that may be, would be the easiest of his options. Saudi Arabia, for their part, they were close to actually doing something very similar to this when Joe Biden was in the White House, a nuclear program in exchange for recognizing Israel. October 7th happened. That put Saudi Arabia in a very difficult spot. If they went through with the deal, it would have looked like they were siding with Israel against the Palestinians. So then they changed their demands to saying, we'll only do this if Israel makes an irreversible process to recognizing a Palestinian state, which I knew Netanyahu never would do. But I believe at this point, the public's attention has shifted away from Gaza. And we know that because Israel's been able to do a lot in Gaza without the media causing an uproar, that Saudi Arabia could go ahead with the original deal without as much of an internal or international backlash.
And I guess part of that as well is those like Benjamin Netanyahu have to deal with Donald Trump at the highest levels and have to deal with the realities of that relationship and try to make judgments about, well, is it worth blowing up this relationship that we need in other ways? Whereas people lower level don't really, they're not necessarily constrained by reality and realpolitik in that same way. So this is a trend we've been seeing for years now, going all the way back to Donald Trump's first term and really long before then, of Israel, the Jewish state in the Middle East, and the United States trusting in these Arab nations across the Middle East. And you saw Donald Trump, for example, introduce the Abraham Accords in his first term in office when he was trying to patch relations up between Israel and these Sunni states. There's a close financial relationship that Andrew's talked about a fair bit in terms of the petrodollar and that these states are propping up America economically. The military partnership has increased. This would really take that partnership to a new level in great many ways. Now, as we've already discussed, there are a lot of reasons not to trust Saudi Arabia and these allies this way. You just look at any kind of opinion polls that tell you what the average person in Saudi Arabia thinks, and it's very far from a Western-style democracy. Islam and even radical strains of Islam and radical beliefs have quite a high level of currency in a lot of these places. And then there's the links to Al-Qaeda and some of those other things that we brought up. You bring in Bible prophecy and we have a very specific warning not to trust these nations. Can you tell us about that, Mihailo?
Yes, the main prophecy would be in Psalm 83, which discusses a group of Middle Eastern peoples coming together, quote, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. That's in verse 4. And this alliance has never happened, either in recorded in the Bible or in secular history, which is why our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has said this is a prophecy for now. And it's worth noting the name of Israel. Okay, there's a state in the Middle East called Israel, and that falls under this umbrella. But it's also talking about the United States and the British peoples as the United States and Britain in prophecy, which we plug often describes. Verse 6 of Psalm 83 mentions the Ishmaelites being among this alliance. Most of these other peoples, you can't really tell off the top of your head who they are, unless if you know a lot about what prophecy says about these peoples and what history says about these peoples. The Ishmaelites are a big exception. Like, going back to Muhammad and the time the Quran was written, they've always believed that they've been the descendants, the peninsular Arabs, I mean, of Ishmael, the biblical patriarch. And to this day, the Arabs, the Ishmaelites, have not forgotten their identity. And of these peninsular Arab countries, Mr. Fleury in a 2021 article talked about the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, these countries that signed the original Abraham Accords being a part of this. But Saudi Arabia is the big one. Saudi Arabia, it holds Islam's holiest cities. It holds the birthplace of Arab civilization. It's the most populous, the biggest economy, the biggest military. It is the face of the Ishmaelite peoples. And we expect Saudi Arabia, especially, to be a key part of this alliance. Where this leaves nuclear weapons, well, Bible prophecy is silent on whether Saudi Arabia will actually get these weapons, or if they will use them. That remains to be seen. But as Mr. Fleury writes in The King of the South, another reason this alliance forms is to counter Iran and radical Islam and Iran trying to be the superpower of the Middle East, as outlined in another prophecy in Daniel 11, which talks about a king of the north, a German-led Europe, countering Iran, and it's the same German-led Europe referred to as Asher or Assyria in Psalm 83. In other words, these Arab countries support Germany against Iran. And there's one quote from the King of the South I'd like to read. "Germany is surrounding Iran and radical Islam just as God prophesied it would. Soon that whirlwind will start rotating and whirling against the King of the South with increasing speed, like a well-armed, probably nuclear-armed vortex," end quote. In other words, Mr. Fleury is expecting Germany and Germany's bloc to use nuclear weapons against Iran. Having Iran's biggest rival in the Arab world, just across from the Persian Gulf, get nuclear weapons could very well play a major role in how this is fulfilled. Either way, it's something definitely to keep an eye on.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. And just to back up with facts, some of those points I was saying about Saudi Arabia still having pretty radical viewpoints and a lot of reasons not to trust them. The Washington Institute did a survey of Saudi Arabian public opinion last summer, and some of the results were pretty worrying. Before October 7th, 10% of Saudis had a positive view of Hamas. Weren't big fans of Hamas, really, because Hamas is quite closely allied with Iran, and Saudi Arabians see that as an enemy. Immediately after October 7th, that jumped to 40% saying they had positive opinions of Hamas. So you want to make the Saudi population like you, at least a significant minority, you kill Jews. And then suddenly they had this massive boost in popularity. Now that has come down. Only 13% of Saudi Arabians say that they view the Abraham Accords positively. Vast majority, they don't want this. They don't want peace with Israel. The Abraham Accords fundamentally is making peace with a nation that hates them. There was another that one of the questions they asked was, "We should listen to those among us who want to interpret Islam in a more moderate, tolerant, and modern direction." Sounds pretty uncontroversial. 47% said, "Yes, we should do that." 51% said, "No." The rest were undecided. So a majority, a narrow majority, are still a substantial minority of modernizers, but most said, "No. We don't want to be more moderate. We don't want to be more tolerant. We don't want to be modern." 66% said that their most important relationship was with China. 57% said it was with Russia, which I guess there's some people there that answered twice. 34% talked about them, said that they should prioritize relations with the United States. 21% said they viewed Donald Trump's policies in the Middle East as being good, so most don't like them. 0% said Joe Biden's policies in the Middle East were good, which I just think is funny. That's almost an achievement to unite a nation so thoroughly against your policies. But this is exactly the attitude the Bible talks about in Psalm 83, that says that this is an alliance dedicated, that the name of Israel should no more be in remembrance, not just blotting Israel off the map, but there is a real hatred there. and wanting to blot Israel out of all memory and history. That is the nation that America is starting to trust with nuclear bombs. Now, they're not the only nation that America trusts with nuclear bombs. They've already lent nuclear bombs to six nations in Europe, and nuclear programs within Europe were very much on in the news this week. I think the most eye-catching was a press release coming from Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service. So, you know, not a reliable source. Let's get that out there right at the start. You know, if you're taking press releases from Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service just as fact, out right off the bat, you know, that's not a great position to be in. This is an organization that is paid to lie. Like, that is their job. With that in mind, though, I think it's still worth listening with a skeptical ear to what they're saying. And they said that Germany is conducting active research and development work with a nuclear weapons focus. They said that actually that the relevant ministries of one of the key NATO states are expressing concern as well. They say that Germany is putting forward a bunch of research in sensitive areas such as specialized material science, shockwave physics, nuclear and neutron physics, which involve 30 national universities. And they said that NATO military experts believe that Berlin is capable of independently developing the necessary fissile material within 1 to 3 months and constructing an operational nuclear explosive device within up to 1 year. Now, I think they're probably mixing truth and error. At this point, nuclear bombs is 80-year-old physics. It's not really cutting edge. So, yeah, I don't know why Germany would need to do much more science to develop a nuclear bomb. Another story this week was a deal that France and Germany signed with Rosatom, the state-owned Russian atomic energy agency, where they will be developing fuel rods for use in basically post-Soviet countries for their kind of Soviet-era nuclear power stations. This is a country with a lot of nuclear know-how. They do know how to make a nuclear bomb. They don't even need to do any research there, though. You know, if that report is true about them doing research, maybe they're looking. I mean, maybe that's engineering challenges. Maybe new types of nuclear weapons. I don't know. Maybe just it's normal civilian research that Russia is repackaging. But certainly, this point about Russia. About Germany being able to independently develop the ingredients for a bomb in about 3 months. Yeah, like this I think is obvious. I don't think anyone would disagree with this, that they could conduct an operational nuclear explosive device within a year. They have the ingredients, they have the nuclear industry, they have the know-how. It would be pretty trivial for them to put together a nuclear bomb. The press report concludes, the intention of the current German authorities to gain direct access to nuclear weapons is already causing extreme concern in Europe, given the revanchist sentiments in Berlin. However, the result of the experience of creating the Wunderwaffe, you know, the wonder weapons, by Nazi Germany is well known. Does history still teach you nothing? In some ways, the Russians do have better memories than we do, and they there may well be some genuine Russian concern there that Germany's looking at developing their own German homegrown nuclear bomb. Now, one way we know they are progressing towards a more independent nuclear bomb is through relationships with France. So they have the nuclear sharing agreement with the United States. They're depending on America to loan them nuclear weapons. That's America giving Germany a whole lot of power. But it means that Germany has that dependence on America. Do a deal with France. Now they've got two nations giving them nuclear weapons. No one country can kind of hold them to ransom by threatening to withdraw that. That really helps them a lot more. And that is perhaps the next best thing to them having their own nuclear weapon. This talks with France have been going on for some time now. And Friedrich Merz brought this up even during the election campaign when he was running for office over a year ago. And on July 16th, so just over a week, two nuclear-capable French Rafale fighter jets, two German Eurofighters, they participated in joint drills that were marking the practical start of nuclear cooperation. That's what Germany's Handelsblatt wrote. And we mentioned that briefly on the show last week. Then after that, you had the Chancellor Merz and the French President Emmanuel Macron getting together with the Franco-German Defense and Security Council at an airbase for a meeting. You know, the two of these working together at a high level and practical way. So this is a very important way that Germany is rising on the world scene, where they're developing the strongest conventional army in Europe, and that power is taking on a nuclear dimension. I mean, even ignoring and setting aside the idea of, is there anything going on secret? Is there anything to this press release from the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service? Just from what we know, from what is public, from what Germany is coming out and saying, yes, we are doing this, Russia's warnings at the end of that press release are absolutely justified. Germany is becoming they're already a nuclear power. They're becoming even more of a nuclear power. They're developing the biggest conventional army in Europe. We should be alarmed, and the entire world is asleep. I mean, you can look at those same prophecies that Mihailo was talking about. I mean, one of the things that it talks about in Psalm 83 is that these allies that want to blot Israel out, and that's Israel referring to all the descendants of biblical Israel, that's the Jews in the Middle East, but that's Britain, that's America as well. It says that they're engaged in crafty councils. And you can look up, well, what does that mean in the Hebrew? They're having secret talks. They have secrets. They have secret programs. They have secret meetings. It's an underground event. You know, they're not publicizing everything that they're doing. And they're working to surprise Britain and America. And many other Bible passages, even Jesus Christ himself talked about, well, they'll be saying peace and safety. They'll say everything looks great. You know, it's all peaceful. We've got all these Abraham Accords signed. We've got Europe working as a peacekeeper in the Middle East. And the attack will just utterly surprise them. That's what these groups are working on. And Britain and America, they're completely asleep to these developments, these very significant developments going on in Germany, where Germany no longer needs America to protect them. And then they're in that position where they could turn against America, even seize a lot of American military assets, like bits of the U.S. Navy and things like that. You know, try and take that over so that they can still have that American military umbrella, but they're not dependent on America for it. They can take control of those resources themselves. So the Bible has urgent, urgent warnings. This is about Europe working with these Middle Eastern countries, ultimately attacking and bringing into captivity the nations of Israel. That is where this is leading, and that's not depending on some sketchy sources within the Russian intelligence service. That is reality. And talking of secret meetings, secret talks, this is something else that caught my eye. German and Russian officials had secret talks in Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijani president said, "Our territory was used for such a meeting without our knowledge." It was initially denied by the German authorities. Chancellor Merz, he said, "I'm not aware of any such meeting." At this same press conference, quite the dramatic press conference, the Azerbaijani president is in a joint press conference with the German chancellor and says, "Germany's having secret meetings with Russia on our soil." The German chancellor, nope, no idea anything about this. And you know, then we had more truth come out. So these meetings, there were meetings between former German and Russian officials on July 12th and July 14th that they've been going on for some time now. The people that were involved, it was a former chief of staff to German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Ronald Pufala, former state president of Brandenburg, Matthias Platzek, the head of the Russian, of Vladimir Putin's Council for Civil Society and Human Rights, Valery Fadayev, and then Viktor Zubkov, the former Russian prime minister, current Gazprom supervisory board chairman. And then according to Die Zelt, ARD and some of the German newspaper news outlets, Alexei Gromyko, he's the director of the Institute of Europe and Russian Academy of Science, was there as well. And then Vladimir Putin, he held private meetings with the former German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder recently. And I think we talked about that on this show. So Russia's warning of Germany. Germany is afraid of Russia. This is very real. But at the same time, these countries in the past have both feared each other and in part due to that fear, worked together, done deals, empowered each other to go after other countries. that's a dynamic that Mr. Gerald Flurry has looked at for some time. In 2018, he wrote that the fact that these two are working so closely together strongly indicates that they agree on a plan to join NATO. So as you have meetings like this, and you know, these are former politicians, there's plausible deniability. How much is this official? How much is this coordinated with the federal government? You know, we don't necessarily know, and the German press is asking those questions, but very much worth paying attention to. And Mr. Flurry's article, Germany's Secret Deal with Russia, has a lot more on the prophetic implications here. You know, this is another form of crafty councils going on that will bring down the United States. Well, final political story from Germany this week. Jens Spahn, one of Germany's top conservative politicians, he was forced out on Saturday. It's a pretty disgusting scandal. He and his homosexual partner, they had paid a surrogate. You know, this is bizarre that this is allowed. You know, they're buying a human being off his mother, basically. That's illegal in Germany. It's opposed by Spahn's party. The fact that he had done this, well, Merz asked him very quickly to resign. And so this has led to a bit of a reshuffle in German politics. I think I think last week as well, Joshua Michels had an article just talking about some of the pretty disgusting moral decline that's happened in Germany. And you saw something similar in the 1930s, and it led to people. I mean, it was one of the ingredients that fueled a desire for authoritarianism and dictators that would kind of keep the worst of this behavior in line, or at least appeared to. There were a lot of pretty perverse behaviors going on under the Nazis as well. But could you see a similar dynamic, you know, wanting to get rid of a lot of this scandal, a lot of this evil, bring in something authoritarian that can take care of a lot of that? I think that's an aspect to this that is worth watching. So a political story within Germany. We'll go to a political story, much bigger political reshuffle within the United Kingdom this week, because it wasn't just Britain getting rid of a few people in the cabinet, one or two politicians. We had a new prime minister. So we'll go to our correspondent for the English-speaking world on this, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, always big news when one of the English-speaking nations gets a new leader. And this new leader that England's gotten, Andy Burnham, could shape up to be quite a historic prime ministership. If things keep going the way they are, it might be a short prime ministership. In the fact that Burnham is actually the seventh prime minister to work in Britain in the 10 years since Brexit. So huge revolving door turnover in prime ministers. But in addition to being the seventh prime minister since Brexit, he's also arguably the most socialist prime minister since the 70s. Making big promises that he wants, like, the biggest changes in Britain in 40 years. Basically, the biggest changes since the entirety of the English political spectrum moved towards conservatism during the Thatcher administration, who was elected in 1979. Also, the first openly Catholic prime minister since the Protestant Reformation. There's been a couple of others. Tony Blair, his wife was Catholic. His kids went to Mass. He oftentimes went to Mass with his kids, but distanced himself from the Catholic Church while in office. Boris Johnson, who was raised Catholic, but then be converted to Anglicanism before he was in. Burnham's, he's still a member of the Catholic Church, so much so that he took his oath of office on the Jerusalem Bible. That's a translation of the Bible that many Catholic MPs in Britain use when they take the oath of office because they don't like the King James Bible or some of the other Protestant translations. So the fact that he's putting his hands on that Bible shows that he is definitely an open Roman Catholic, a self-avowed socialist, and the latest in a long line of prime ministers who've trying to fix Britain's problems since the Brexit campaign.
Yeah, it's been an interesting week because he had this pretty bizarre speech on Friday that was billed as his first big kind of policy speech, where he promised to take Britain back to the 1970s. which you literally the kind of the final winter of labor in the 1970s was known as the winter of discontent, that it got so bad. You know, inflation was up at 25%, which still makes today's look pretty good. That was much earlier in the 70s, but so much went wrong economically. It really was Britain learning by experience that socialism doesn't work. And it led to the rise of Margaret Thatcher and just a really phenomenal streak of time in office for her. It took Labour almost 20 years to come back in power after that. And they had to come back in power through Tony Blair, who relaunched the party basically as New Labour and said, well, we're not like those socialists in the 1970s. So to see him come back and then say, you know, we're going back to the, it's like, wow, you know, we really have learned nothing. And we're really desperate. You know, we're out of ideas if you're going back to ideas that comprehensively failed 40 years ago. Now, at the same time, we have seen him do things that are just not obviously stupid, which is kind of refreshing. And so, for example, one of the first policies that he came up with was cancel digital ID cards and use the money that we were going to spend implementing digital ID cards to lower the taxes on energy. It kind of seems like a no-brainer. I know plenty of people that don't care about digital ID cards. I know plenty of people that don't like digital ID cards. I don't know anybody that actually wants them or support. Like, you don't upset anybody. Nobody is sorry to see digital ID cards go. And yeah, then you can spend the money on making people's bills cheaper. So we've seen some of that this week. As he goes on, though, the real challenge will be money and finances. That's also something we saw this week. British borrowing was worse than expected. Interest rates are rising. He wants to be able to give away. He wants also to be able to cut taxes. You know, it's easy to look at bankruptcy, a nation going into debt, as a slow, gradual process. Was it Stanley Johnson who said, how do you go bankrupt, like, slowly and then all at once? Like, it can be slow until it's not, and you can reach a kind of a crisis point. And Britain is frighteningly close to that kind of crisis point where we start spending too much money, and very quickly financial institutions will demand much, much higher interest rates. Because, like, we don't think this is sustainable. We don't think that you're going to be able to pay this money back. And if interest rates start escalating, well, then interest is a massive chunk of the government's bill. And so you kind of fall off a cliff. And so Burnham is wanting to fund lots of giveaways without falling off this cliff edge. That's not going to be easy. And it's that financial situation that I think will make his life very difficult. This is partly why I think we've had seven prime ministers, because the prime minister isn't in charge anymore. The borrower is servant to the lender. I liked a lot of what Liz Truss announced. The people that lent the government money didn't. And it's their opinion that really mattered. So she was out of office in just a matter of days. When you're in this much debt, the prime minister isn't really in charge. And there's not a huge amount they can do to turn it around. It would require some pretty radical measures to fix things.
Yeah, it's actually, to me, a weird shift in the socialist movement that we see on both sides of the Atlantic. We see it here too with, like, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders movement, where the initial socialist, like early 19th century socialist, wanted the government to nationalize industries and actually run them. Then as you moved in the mid 1900s, you moved more towards social democracy, where the government didn't really nationalize industries, but they raised taxes extremely high for wealth redistribution. You just raise taxes, and then the government has all that money to implement social problems. More recently, even here in the United States, you see that too, where, like, Bernie Sanders, like, he's not aggressively pushing for tax increases, but he is aggressively pushing for government spending. And I think even some old school socialists, like the comedian Bill Maher in the United States, said, he's like the ideology they're pushing, it's it's not so much socialism as it is Santaism. They just want free stuff. They want a magical fat man to come down the chimney and give them free stuff. With no plan to pay for it. And he even said, he's like, real socialists have a tax plan to pay for their programs. He's like, these new Santaists, he's like, they have no tax plan to pay for their programs. I guess they just assume, like, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's deep into what they call modern monetary theory. The idea that, like, since the government, it's not really modern, they just repackage it modern, but, like, it's like the idea that since the government can print money, they can just give you free stuff and not raise taxes, which of course creates inflation, which is a secret tax on the people. So you're taxed one way or another. But it is interesting. I'm seeing a lot of socialists, both the Labour Party in Britain and in the United States, who they're still advocating massive government spending to just give out all these free social programs. But they're not actually pushing for a tax plan that could fund it, which is just, it's irrational thinking. Because, like, a country like Denmark, yeah, university's free, healthcare is free, a lot of stuff is free in Denmark. But, like, the median tax rate's 60%. So they're... I don't advocate that theory, but they do actually have a tax plan that can pay for a lot of their social programs. Where Britain and America, Bernie Sanders might be like, oh, we want Scandinavian-style socialism. It's like, but you don't. I don't agree with Scandinavian-style socialism, but it's different from what you're pushing. Yours is like in a magical interpretation of the will where you want free stuff and have no plan to pay for it. And it's even rubbed off on conservatives. That's why, and this is shocking to me, and I talk about America's national debt a lot, but like Britain's national debt is rising faster than any nation in the world except Botswana, which is not known as a place that's in a financially good position. So, when your national debt's raising that fast, that just means you're spending a lot of money and not bringing in a lot of money. And that's this type of, like, if you want to use Bill Maher's Santaist philosophy, where you want free gifts, but you're not only are you not working for it yourself, you're not even robbing from rich people to pay for it. You're just putting it on the proverbial credit card and hoping it will all work out.
Yeah, I think in Britain, I mean, Andy Burnham, he is kind of more of an old style socialist when it comes to nationalization. He's talked a lot about that. He hasn't actually proposed that much that's dramatic in terms of specifics. I think it's Thames Valley Water Company he wants to nationalize. He wants to nationalize the railways. There are some, but he's still quite a distance from some of the kind of 1970s radicalism where they wanted to, I think it was Tony Benn, wanted to nationalize just the 25 biggest industries in Britain. That's it. FTSE 100, you're now owned by the government. But he is very pro-nationalization. One of the big downsides of that is if you nationalize all the railways, all of this business debt is now government debt. So you've made your government debt situation at a stroke a whole lot worse. The other thing I think that applies both to Britain and America that's this big fantasy is that you can have massive government spending that doesn't affect you or me, the way that the government's put it, by just taxing the rich. And you have this in Bernie Sanders is big about this. Andy Burnham is talking about a wealth tax. And this idea that you can have free stuff and the vast majority of the people in this country, the voters, you're not going to have to pay for it because we're not going to raise your taxes. We're only going to raise the taxes on the rich. And you basically, those that agree with it, the rich are generally anybody richer than what they are currently. I saw an interesting survey where most millionaires were in favor of taxing the rich, but they believe that that tax should start on people that had a net worth of like 50 million, not just 1 or 2 million. So tax anybody who's just a bit richer than I am is the way of looking at it. And it's dangerous. It's really seductive. You can get great stuff. It's the politics of envy. This is so much of the way that we talk about the world now. Those that are rich, rich nations are there because they exploited poor nations. Rich people are there because they exploited poor people. It's a zero-sum game. The only reason anybody is wealthy is because they stole it from somebody else. That's kind of the leftist view, and that's what this feeds into. And then it destroys the country. Britain right now, we've got this really skewed tax system. If you're earning in a minimum wage, you pay no tax. Tax burden in general is getting close to being the highest it has ever been in peacetime. And it's actually starting to raise higher than it's been since World War II. But if you're on minimum wage, no tax. And then the marginal tax rate raises very, very sharply. And in fact, you can actually, if you're earning about £100,000, there's a weird quirk in the tax system. Unfortunately, it's not a problem I have to worry about. But if you're on £100,000, your income can go up and the amount of money you get in the take home at the end of the month effectively goes down. You're getting taxed. The marginal rate is more than 100%. For every pound that you earn extra, the government takes more than a pound off you. And then if there's all of the already what it's led to is more countries leaving, more millionaires left Britain in the last 12 months than any other nation on the planet, more than China. And what happens when all of your businessmen leave? You have no dynamism in the economy. Like the Elon Musks, the people that start new companies move elsewhere. Your economy gets sick and dies. So, okay, the politician has told me we're going to tax the rich and not you. You can have all this free stuff. And don't worry, it's not going to mean any more government taking your money, any more money out of your pocket. But then I lose my job. Or, okay, I keep my job, but inflation is really high and pay isn't growing and productivity isn't growing. And the national economy is doing bad, and that absolutely does hit me. But, okay, it's not the government taking more money out of my pocket. And I think that's, Andy Burnham is talking about a wealth tax. And a wealth tax will just turbocharge a millionaire's exodus. Because that doesn't tax you on income, it taxes you on wealth. So you think about pensioners potentially, somebody who has never earned very much money, but they bought their house at the right time. And so their house is very valuable. They could end up having an income of £20,000 and a tax bill of £30,000. Some would say that's fair, others not. Another big, Norway introduced a wealth tax, and you had entrepreneurs say, I have no choice but to leave. I would like to stay, but I have a company that I've started. It is losing money every year, but on paper, it's worth £20 million because that's what investors have put into it. So on paper, I am really wealthy right now and I'm struggling to eat because I'm pouring everything into this company. And yeah, in the long run, I think I probably will be very rich. But I do, like, if I'm being charged an annual tax based on the value of my company, I don't have that money. So you've had people just fleeing Norway. Norway then tried to introduce an exit tax. If you're an entrepreneur and you try to leave, well, we'll charge you when you leave. Now the result is people in Norway are saying, I'm thinking of starting a business, therefore I need to get out of here. So this is the kind, like, it's just so economically destructive. And that's what they're potentially looking at bringing to Britain now.
Yeah, the American founding father, John Adams, actually had a bit to say about wealth taxes. And he put it quite plainly where he said really, it's breaking the Ten Commandments, particularly the commandment, thou shalt not steal. In ancient Israel, there was a tithe or a flat tax of 10% where everyone, rich, poor, young, old, like any, your increase, you paid 10% so that the Levitical priesthood, who were in charge of like making the judgments, had money to run their government. So it's not unethical to have taxes to run a government. But specifically taking money using the force of the government, like you go to jail if you don't pay your taxes, taking money from someone who's more successful, and giving it to someone who's not, it introduces a double standard where some people, if the more successful you are, the more you have to pay, and you're redistributing this money, not as charity, where the rich are, because they've been blessed by God, giving some of their money to those who aren't, but just taking money that, oh, you have money, so I'm going to take that from you and give it to someone else. It's like that was their property, and that type of wealth redistribution, it's not just wrong because it drives people out of the country or it makes it harder to start businesses. I mean, those are the physical effects that hurt your nation when you do that. But actually morally wrong in the fact that you're stealing as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you made that. That, you know, God's law does operate on a principle of cause and effect, and you break the law and there will be negative effects for that. But, you know, the big problem is they're breaking the law. As a nation, we should have learned a lot of these economic lessons from the 70s. We should have. We could, like, there's no excuse. These are principles of God's law. They're revealed in the Bible. They're also pretty obvious to so many of them, to anyone that just looks at a bit of economic history. And did you have anything more on this and on Britain's new prime minister or anything else from the English-speaking world?
Well, we're on the topic of finance. The U.S. military is running out of money. Its war on Iran has been going since the end of February. It's recordedly cost around $100 billion. Because Congress hasn't declared war or even approved the military action yet, Congress hasn't approved additional funding. So the military's just been using the normal amount of money allotted to it in its budget. And it did have some reserves that it can use for things like this, but it is running out of funds. And so going to Congress, looking for ways to actually get more money into its coffers to continue this war. So another big financial story in there. We'll see what Congress does. This kind of ties us back to some of the points we were making in the earlier in the show about just America's will to see this through. It's like right now, because this war is unpopular, Congress hasn't approved it. President Trump's just been kind of using what latitude he has as the commander-in-chief to handle this. But America may not be able to continue this much longer without Congress actually coming in and saying that, like, okay, we need to approve additional funding, either funded by new taxes or additional borrowing for this conflict. Second story on the topic of stealing is that China is stealing AI technology. They just launched a new open AI chatbot called Kimi K3. And they've had several hearings at Congress saying that they've basically set up a network of Chinese chatbots that, like, log on to Claude or other GPT and, like, ask them questions in order to basically extract U.S. AI technology that they can use for their Chinese models. And according to the latest congressional hearings, they said they expected China was going to be about 1 to 2 years behind the United States in the AI technology race. But because of industrial espionage and other technology mimicking, China's actually probably only 6 to 9 months behind the United States. And since AI, it does have military and other technologies, that theft is constituting a real national security threat that the United States is going to have to deal with.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Thank you to all of you that have joined us today. Thank you to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. One of our free books I'll mention as we wrap up the show is our book, Jerusalem in Prophecy. We've been talking a lot about the double cross coming against Israel in the Middle East and really all of Israel, the nations of Israel around the world. That book, Jerusalem in Prophecy, We'll let you turn to the scriptures that talk about that and dig into that yourself. We'd be very happy to send that to you, or you can read it online, as you can with just about all of our literature, on our website, thetrumpet.com. We will be back next week. I think we've got an update from Australia for our Wednesday show. If you have any questions, any comments, please do send them to us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. And until then, keep watching your world.